the Buddha, Shri Dharma, Shri Sangha. This talk's a continuation of the last talk on having compassion for ourselves and how it relates to the love of the eternal. I talked about the three pure precepts and in a general way about the ten precepts. It's in the three refuges, the three treasures precepts, that we really see the deepest meaning of having compassion for ourselves. You know, of course, those three refuges are normally taken as I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, and I take refuge in the Sangha. And River Master did a little fine-tuning on that at some point. There's nothing willful about that. I'm sure they came up for her as a really important teaching at some point. She reworded them somewhat to say, I take refuge in the eternal. I take refuge in that which the eternal teaches. I take refuge in those who know the eternal. And I have always found this so incredibly helpful. She felt so strongly about that that she wrote it on the back of roxas for people, you know. And you know, I couldn't agree more with her on the importance of that. So let's just take a look at it briefly. I take refuge in the eternal. I take refuge in my own true nature. I take refuge in my own true heart. I take my refuge in my own greater self. I take refuge in the Buddha within myself. Pure meditation. How you do that. Turning towards your own true nature and listening in utter willingness. In Christianity, they have a nice term, waiting upon the Lord. Waiting upon the Lord. And that fits too. I take refuge in that which the eternal teaches. The Dharma that is the living, flowing Dharma. The teaching that comes directly from our own heart to us. Of course, in reality, there's no from and to, and there's a certain sense in which there is a from and to. I am not God, and there is nothing in me that is not of God. On the I am not God side, there's the from and the to. And it's important not to forget that. If you forget that there's that which is greater than yourself, then you confuse your own opinions with the teaching that comes from your heart. And they're not the same thing. The third of the refuges she then reworded slightly as, I take refuge in those who know the eternal. I began the last talk, the first talk in this pair, by talking about taking refuge in those in whom it is wise to take refuge and not taking refuge in those in whom it is not wise to take refuge. And this way in which River Master words the refuge, I take refuge in the Sangha, rewording it slightly as I take refuge in those who know the eternal. Now this really points up how important this is. Everyone has the Buddha nature. Everyone has the capacity to be a vessel for their greater self. At any particular time, it doesn't seem like all that many people are putting all that much effort into doing that. So if you can find a few people, or even one person who's doing that, then there you have a true Sangha refuge. And even then, you're responsible for listening to your own heart on whether to go to this person at the present time or not. Or these people at the present time or not. Your first responsibility is always to listen to your own heart. Your master says, know that you will take the consequences of what you do. A good starting point, remember. Because I take the consequences of my actions, before I go running off to someone else to find out what I should do, I need to really listen to my own heart a bit. Because they're not going to be the person who takes the consequences for my actions. They're going to get the consequences of their actions. They give me a bad advice, well, they get the consequences, whatever that is. But if I take bad advice from someone else, then I'm not actually really listening to the good advice of my own heart. Know that you get the consequences of your actions. Other people get the consequences of their actions. This is where I'm going to put in a little footnote on love and light heresy, which is some way Reverend Master sometimes described it, their love and light delusion. It's so prevalent in Western society, very prevalent in what passes for both Buddhism and Christianity, I'm sure other religions as well, at kind of popular level. And it is such a deadly thing. And it goes like this. You know, I've said this before, but it's worth saying again, because you can sure get suckered by this one. I mean, it's so easy to get suckered by it. Well, everyone has the Buddha nature. So everyone is the vessel of the truth. Dogen says this. Every day is a good day. Everyone is the vessel of the truth. That's true. Everyone has a Buddha nature. And not everyone's acting like it. If you forget that and not everyone's acting like it, and you just proceed naively, like, well, everyone's got the Buddha nature, so, you know, I just take whatever advice from whoever and take a little bit here and a little bit there and kind of find my way, you know, by that means, you're getting terrible, terrible trouble. And this is made, one of the reasons there's so many subtleties to this, but one of them is that when you're a sincerely religious person and you recognize in other people that they're sincerely religious too, and then you can easily jump, make a little jump here that kind of overlooks the fact that, well, yes, they're sincerely religious too, and it's a wonderful thing. There's no question about that. It is a wonderful thing. Anytime you encounter anyone who's sincerely religious, it's a gift. And I always experience it as such, and there's an immediate sense of recognition and a sense of communion on a spiritual level with anyone who's sincerely doing any religious practice. That is a genuinely perceptual practice. And that still doesn't mean that that person or those people are necessarily the right refuge for you. The Eternal gives you your Sangha refuge. And generally speaking, as a general rule of thumb, it's best to stick to what you've been given. And to listen very carefully before you go outside. You can be so easily suckered just by sincerity. You know, people can be sincerely on track, and they can also be very sincerely off track. If you can find even one person who's sincerely on track, that person's a good refuge. And you're not going to find more than a few, at any one time anyway. Reverend Master used to have a saying, when I didn't hear her say it in later years, but in early years she's saying it all the time. Know many, trust a few, always paddle your own canoe. I don't know where she got that, because I never heard anyone say it before her, but I don't think she made it up. Know many, trust a few, always paddle your own canoe. But I'll tell you, that is such good advice. You'll have a general awareness of general situation, general conditions. That's knowing many. Have a few people you know you can trust, and do trust them. And always be responsible for yourself and look out for yourself. Paddle your own canoe. Never cede your responsibility for yourself to anyone else. You'll get in terrible trouble. Of course, you can't really cede it, and that's the problem. You try to cede it to someone else, and you're still going to get the consequences of your actions. You can't cede it away. So accept the fact and paddle your own canoe. So how is this being kind to oneself? Well, I think it should be obvious that if you don't live in this way, you just get in all kinds of trouble that you avoid if you live in this way. However, if you live in this way, you don't avoid all trouble, because no one avoids all trouble. But so let's talk about the kind of trouble you're going to avoid and the kind of trouble you're going to get into if you follow your own heart. Generally speaking, the kind of trouble you're going to avoid is the kind of trouble that keeps you caught in the round of birth and death. The kind of trouble that perpetuates ignorance and perpetuates craving, that feeds the roots of suffering, which are greed, hate, and delusion. That's the kind of trouble you're going to avoid. The kind of trouble you're not going to be able to avoid is in sometimes clashing with the world and going against the popular flow of things. You're not going to be able to avoid that at times. Your master so often spoke of standing against the world to train in wisdom. And if you think you're getting off the hook by not doing that, because it is a lot easier in many respects to just go with the world. But going with the way of the world keeps you in the world. It keeps your stream of karma in the world. So it keeps you bound to the wheel of birth and death. Standing against the world does not mean having a knockdown, drag-out fight with the world. It means not doing those things that are not good to do while doing those things that are good to do. Not doing the things that are not good to do, and instead doing the things that are good to do. There's another little verse in the Bible. I realize I can be criticized for quoting so much Bible, in my Dharma talks, but I could be criticized for never quoting Bible in my Dharma talks too, I suppose. But I learned a lot of Bible verses when I was a little kid. We had to memorize them, and there's some good ones. Well, this one, rightly understood, is a very good one. Wrongly understood, it's not such a good one, but rightly understood, it's a good one. And it's just a short little verse, "When sinners entice thee, consent thou not." When sinners entice thee. That's a King James version, you know. "Consent thou not." Do you remember that one? It's a good one. You don't get some kind of gold star spiritually for going along with something that you know in your heart to be goofy. When sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Don't go along with things you know in your heart to be goofy. Whoever it is that's putting them to you. How you go about not going along with them also matters. You know, so instead of, you know, pulling out a 45 and shooting someone who's in trying enticing you to do what's wrong, you know, perhaps you can just kind of be somewhere else, you know, if possible. In other words, don't overreact. One listens to one's heart for what is good to do, what is good to join in with, and what is not good to join in with. One listens to one's own heart for how it is good to proceed in going along with something or not going along with something. You never cede away your responsibility for yourself. What you do and how you do it, you get the consequences of your actions. The law of karma, the teachings about the law of karma are so liberating, and they clarify so much about how in a practical way how to live. But there's so much more helpful when you combine the teaching on the law of karma with what meditation really is and what it's meant to be. Taking refuge in your own heart. And you can then combine the two. Watching out for the consequences of your actions, the potential consequences of your actions. You know, looking before you leap. And at the same time, really listening to your heart. So that you're not just doing the watching out from your head, but you're doing the watching out from a deeper level. And then you're in a much, much better place spiritually from which to act. Because the head so often, with the best of intentions, gets it wrong. The heart never gets it wrong. And, of course, we can think at a given time that we, in a given situation, we're hearing our heart and following it when perhaps we're not. But you can't remove that risk and that difficulty. You have to learn to train with it. And learn from experience. Learn from the consequences of your actions when you got it right and when you didn't. Now, I want to expand a little bit on this matter of the nature of karmic consequence. Now, I've talked about this before, but there's three periods of karmic consequence. And the way I understand this is that there's the period of karmic consequence which follows immediately upon an action. Then there's a period of karmic consequence that follows, you might say, a kind of middle length term, and that might extend out the rest of this present life. And then there's the kicker, and that's the one where consequences of one's actions go on into future, possible future lives. The real long-term consequences of actions. So when you are aware that karmic consequence can have shorter-term, middle-term, and longer-term forms, then when you consider, what is it to really be kind to oneself? It throws into relief what real compassion to oneself is. So, from this point of view, from the point of view of the way, understanding something about the way karma and rebirth work, obviously the actions which are really kind to ourselves are the ones that, even if they put us into shorter term difficulties, keep us out of longer term difficulties. Even if they get us into shorter term trouble in some respect or other, they do not feed the roots of suffering and lead to rebirth. In other words, they don't increase the deep need, deep spiritual need, to the extent to which, you know, it just doesn't have a chance in this lifetime, and it's got to show up in some life of some other poor, you know, person down the line, who then has to try to do something about it. So this is why a lot of really religious people have such a very hard time. A lot of deeply religious people have such a very hard time. There's this kind of illusion, and I can only call it that, a delusion really, about what it means to be a monk. And you see it, I've seen it on TV programs portraying the peaceful, serene life of people living in a monastic community like it's some kind of picnic. And of course, it's anything but that. It's very difficult. And the reason why it's difficult, there's a good karmic reason why it's difficult. Because you're focusing on doing that which enables the past load of karma to get cleaned up and get its help. And you're also working on not doing that, which is going to create loads more for the future. So, you know, it's like you're trying to stop a rolling train. You're trying to put the brakes on it so it can't keep shooting on into future lives. And while you're doing that, you're getting the karmic consequence coming due that might have come due in the future lives. But because you gave your life to the eternal, that karma is going to come due in this life. So you can start reaping when you become a monk, and people often, you know, experience it. They may not understand it in the way I'm describing it, but this is the, you might say, the theory behind the sad, or the difficult reality. It's actually not a sad reality. It's a happy reality, but it don't feel too happy when you're going through it. That when people become monks, they often experience, and you know, all hell breaks loose. They start having problems they never had before, and they can be just feeling lousy. You know, they can be health problems. Pretty well, your whole body and mind is up for grabs. Well, karmic consequences come and do. You said you're willing. The Eternal says, right, this person's willing. Let's get him let's pay off the past debt. Let's not accumulate more. You know? This is the greatest kindness you can do to yourself. But it's not a picnic. So you have to have an expanded view of what it is to have true compassion for yourself. I hope that in talking about this and teaching about it, that it will help us all have more compassion for our fellow monks, our fellow Sangha members, not just monks, but lay trainees too, but especially monks, when they hit a really rough patch and they stumble. Sometimes you hit such a rough patch, you stumble and you end up face down in the mud. And that's not pretty for oneself, it's not pretty for others. And please remember when this happens to others, and if you can remember it with others, you're more likely to remember it with yourself if it happens to you. If it doesn't happen to you, well, more power to you. You're better than me because it's happened to me any number of times. And people are so often so hard on themselves, and we can be very hard on others when this happens. But do remember what a very difficult thing a person is trying to do in becoming a true disciple of the Buddha. And do remember that a person said yes and they really meant it, and the Eternal heard that, and now the karma comes due. And at any point in this lifetime, some pretty hard karmas can whack. And when that's happening, people can get pretty frantic and pretty ungrounded. What is it to have compassion for oneself when this happens? It is to catch oneself, to do sangha if one's made mistakes in the process, pick oneself up and go on, you know, looking up. However great the darkness may be, go on looking up. Take one step at a time. You'll get through the darkness. Take one step at a time. Take refuge in the Buddha. Take refuge in the Dharma. Take refuge in the Sangha. Keep up the meditation. Take refuge in the Buddha. Listen to your own heart. Keep listening to your own heart. No matter how distant you may feel from it at times, keep listening. Be patient. I take refuge in that which the Eternal teaches. And when it's good to do so, seek the help and support of those who know the Eternal. I take refuge in the Sangha. And you can get through it then. And you'll find that you are being helped. If one can be thus compassionate to oneself, then one can be thus compassionate to others. If one cannot be thus compassionate or will not be thus compassionate oneself, then one is going to have a very hard time being compassionate in that way to others as well. The Master so often spoke of Sangha as self-forgiveness. Remember that, self-forgiveness. When, you know, we're going to get the consequence of our actions, whether we forgive ourselves or not. And true Sangha makes it the consequences easier to bear because, it, as Dogen says, it brings freedom and immaculacy. The way in which all of this connects with the love of the Eternal is very simple. For a long time, you know, we think that we're the one doing all the struggling and all the carrying the load. But one day we're able at last to really surrender to the Eternal. Then we find that that perception of things was only partly correct, but it was mostly incorrect, that we were always being helped every step of the way, and that even within the greatest, deepest suffering, There was the help, and the suffering was itself part of the help. I have to do it. I'm working out a talk that I may do this retreat, or I may have to put off till later. But it's on how you make Tennessee whiskey, and I have to put off till that talk. Which I learned from, you know, that show How It's Made in one of my all-time favorite TV shows, the hour show they did on how they make Jack Daniels. But there's so much good teaching in how to make Jack Daniels. And an especially helpful part of this teaching is the way in which the path, our karmic inheritance, and all the suffering that comes from it is itself help. But I'll have to put off till I do that talk, because there's a handy metaphor. There's a handy metaphor in there for it. But that is the case. That the help was always there. Everything that happens really and truly is for my good. So while I am learning to have true compassion for myself, and hopefully compassion for others as well, all the while, that is only possible that I can learn that, because it's all taking place, the whole process is taking place within the context of infinite love. And the whole process is a manifestation of infinite love. There's another little thing from the show, How It's Made, that I'll mention that I keep having come up in my mind with regard to this. And there's a thing where they show some bottles being washed before something's put in them. And it may have been the Jack Daniels one, or it may have been another one. But so this is all being done automatically by machines. And so a bunch of bottles, say maybe about a dozen bottles, comes down this conveyor. And then this machine grabs them and turns them upside down. And then that's like this soapy water that shoots up into them and washes them. And then they get a rinse, I guess. And then the machine turns it back up again, upright again. Well, it's kind of like, to me, that's a good metaphor for we're kind of tootling along, thinking that we're the ones doing all the heavy lifting. Then we've surrendered, and the whole thing gets turned upside down, but which is actually kind of right side up in a certain way. But they're both actually right side up. But the whole thing gets turned upside down, and all of a sudden, everything's seen from another point of view. Master Mokugan so accurately expresses it from her own experiences that she felt she got kicked out of the driver's seat at a certain point. And once you're kicked out of the driver's seat, you see things from the non-driver's seat point of view. And all of a sudden, oh, all that time I thought I was the one doing the heavy lifting, the Eternal was carrying me. And that goes on for a while like that, and then they get turned up again. And now they're turned up, and you have to go on, because you always have to do your part, and you're responsible to remember that the Eternal is doing the greater part. You've all heard the saying, in the beginning, mountains are mountains. Then mountains aren't mountains anymore. Then mountains are mountains again. That's a Zen saying. Is that how that goes? Yeah. And it's saying the same thing. In the beginning, mountains are mountains. However, one has a deluded point of view. Then enlightenment happens and the whole thing gets reversed. The one's seeing things right. Then mountains and aren't mountains anymore. Nothing's the same anymore. Everything's seen from a completely different point of view. The non-driver's seat point of view. everything in terms of the eternal, not in terms of selves. And then it flips back. Then mountains and mountains again. Because you have to go on living in the daily life, in ordinary daily life. And you have to keep making your effort. But now mountains are mountains and mountains aren't mountains. In the third position there. In these two talks, I haven't quoted the line that I should quote before I end these two talks, because it's always been something that had been so meaningful to me and puzzled me for so many years. But in the Denkoroku, Keizan says that Shakyamuni Buddha turned the stream of compassion within and was enlightened. And that's what it is to meditate truly. It's what it is that we're doing, turning the stream of compassion within. Not splattering it outwards into external things, staying within our true center and allowing it to circulate within ourselves so that the Eternal can do the work within our heart. The Eternal here is our own Buddha nature, not something external to us. Should the Buddha, should the Dharma, should the Sangha.